welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Deacon of St. James when we come back. Hey, let me ask you this. What's wrong with the Ten Commandments? It's obvious today that something is wrong with the Ten Commandments because they have been banned from our public schools, banned from our public institutions, and banned from our national consciousness. Now, instead of these ten simple time-tested laws, we now see the ten planks to the Communist Manifesto in their place. And they teach the ten planks to the Communist Manifesto in our schools and our public institutions. We've made them a part of our national psyche. You know, this is a radical change in our political and moral outlook over the past 50 years. Are you aware that your daughter couldn't receive an aspirin in your public school without your consent, but she can have an abortion? That's right, an abortion arranged through that same public school nurse without even your knowledge, much less your consent. That's why I contend that the solution to this moral perversion and national insanity is to go back to what worked. Let's go back to the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law. Our founding fathers practiced and advocated the Ten Commandments, and they even put 22 principles of that law into our federal constitution. And there's still one school left in America that teaches this entire Mosaic Law, that is the Ten Commandments. All 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, as well as the penalties for the violation of that law, and the 33 benefits that you receive for their observance. You know, every law has a penalty. You do not have to know what the penalty of a law is to suffer its effects. So whether you call that the Mosaic Law or the Law of God, the Common Law, Natural Law, Karma, it's automatic. And it works just like AIDS, herpes, and VD, which just happens to be the natural penalty for adultery. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package. Now, that's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free of charge. And you can call and order yours right now. The number is 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to the webpage georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send an email request for your free General Law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, gather around, boys and girls. It's story time. Story time. The Deacon of St. James, a fellow by the name of John Longstreet, back in 1765, was the head deacon at the big cathedral, the big Episcopal church called St. James in London, England. 1765, a long time ago. Well, old John was a religious fellow, and at age 20, he was an usher in the church who had just recently been made a junior deacon. A very righteous fellow, a moral fellow, and a bright and upcoming young fellow in the church. As the years went on, he became a full deacon, and then later he had made the rank of the head deacon of St. James, a very prestigious position in the church. Head deacon of St. James. And old John now was in his 50s, about 55. He had been a deacon for more than 30 years. But John had a deep, dark secret. He was illiterate. He couldn't read or write, which wasn't unordinary or unusual or out of the ordinary, I guess I should say, for 1765, most people were not educated. Most people were not literate. But the church hierarchy had come to the conclusion that the deacons, especially the head deacon of the Episcopal Church, should be literate, should be educated. And they gave John just 6 months to learn to read and write. Now, you know, old John now is in his 50s, and for this man to go out and learn to read and write at his age wasn't very likely. And John set to the task, and he worked hard. His wife also was illiterate. His wife, Mary, was a righteous woman. She was a wonderful wife. They'd raised their children. Their children were now off and in the world and doing their thing in life. And John and Mary lived in a little house on John's salary. Even as the head deacon, he didn't make a lot of money, but he was a very thrifty fellow. John and Mary had saved about 300 pounds. It wasn't much, but 300 pounds would be about like $3,000 today. Just multiply it by about 10. They didn't have enough to retire on, that's certainly true. But then in 1765, no one thought of retirement. People thought of poverty. And they did the best they could to make as much as they could in life so that it would ease their burden in their old age. Not that he was going to retire. There was no Social Security. He didn't have a 401k. He didn't have a retirement package from the church. But John had worked hard all of his life. He was honest. He was conscientious. Mary was the same. They were a lovely couple. And now a problem develops. Well, at the end of 6 months, John was unable to learn how to read and write. And as the bishop had told him, that if you can't read and write, we'll have to terminate you as a deacon of St. James, which indeed did occur, and John was terminated. John was devastated, of course, having spent his entire life dedicated to the church and the service of the congregation. Now, being sent home with nothing to do, John moped about the house with a small savings of only 300 pounds, and he didn't know how long he might live, and with nothing else, no other skills, he wasn't a skilled carpenter. He wasn't a skill, or didn't have any skill as a blacksmith or anything that was useful in the trade. Being unable to read and write, he certainly couldn't get employment in a bank or in a government position. Well, Mary had an idea, and Mary said to John, "You know, John, you've always wanted to be a tobacconist. In the back of your mind, you've always desired to be a tobacconist." And indeed, John was a smoker. He smoked a pipe. And the colonies were producing tobacco, and tobacco was a very popular commodity in England in the 1760s. And while John had talked about being a tobacconist, it was really not something that he'd thought too much about. And with only 300 pounds in their entire life savings, should they risk 300 pounds, their entire savings, on something as speculative as becoming a tobacconist? Well, John thought about it, and Mary and John prayed about it, and as time progressed along, they came to a conclusion that they would take the 300 pounds and rent a small shop on Piccadilly Circus. And John would become a tobacconist, and they would see if this, then, could be the means by which they could support themselves. So John opened a store on Piccadilly Circus, and it was a startling success. And John not only was able to provide a living for he and Mary, or John and Mary, he actually made more money and was able to save money. And the following year, he opened a second tobacco store. And every year, for 14 years, John opened one new tobacco store in London for 14 years and was now presiding over a little kingdom of 14 tobacco stores. Well, John, in the meantime, over the 14 years, had saved quite a bit of money. In fact, he had £265,000. Now, £265,000 in today's money, just multiply that times 10, and you'd have about $2,650,000 in today's dollars. Now, if you translate that, or that'd be into pounds, and if you translate that into dollars, you multiply that times about 5, and here's a man who's got about $10 million. About $10 million in 1765 purchasing power. Now, boys and girls, that's a lot of money. A lot of money to be made by a man who was illiterate and started on a shoestring of only 300 pounds when he opened his first tobacco store. Well, John received a letter from the Bank of England. Now, remember, John couldn't read, and in the 14 years that he'd been in the tobacco business, he hadn't learned how to read. He still was illiterate. So after having received a letter from the Bank of England, not being able to read it, he took it to a friend who read the letter. And when he read the letter said, in effect, that the money that John had in the Bank of England on deposit was most improperly invested. And the banker had requested John to come into the bank and talk to him about it. Now, John didn't know quite what the bank meant by his money had been most improperly invested. And he was a little bit concerned and nervous about, well, perhaps he had broken the law, or maybe he had done something that was improper. John, being a somewhat timid fellow, you know, his background being religion and head deacon of St. James, he went into the Bank of England on the day appointed, and he was being interviewed by the banker about his investments. The money was on deposit, but it wasn't being invested. And John pointed out that he really didn't know very much about investments, and that he was not the type to be investing his money, so he had just deposited in the bank and was happy with the paltry amount of interest that was being paid, and he was satisfied. But the banker pressed him a little further and asked him why, with this amount of money, that he did not invest that money to make more money. And John, being illiterate and all, didn't want to admit, of course, that he was illiterate. And as time progressed in the interview, it became apparent that John was more than just reticent about being illiterate, but he was trying to hide it, and the banker was pushing it even more. And finally, John blurted out to the banker, he said, "Well, the truth of the matter is, I can't read or write. And because I'm illiterate, I cannot read, and I wouldn't know what to invest my money in." The banker was absolutely incredulous. Couldn't believe what he'd heard. He said, "What? What? Did I hear you correctly, man? Have you said I cannot read and write?" And John said, "Yes. Yes, that's true. I can't read or write." And the banker blurted out, "My God, man, do you know where you might be today if you could read and write?" And John looked at him and said, "Yes, sir. I would be the head deacon of St. James." Now, you know, as you listen to the Law Hour and editorial review, we present some pretty morose stories. Stories about the economy, and stories about government and chicanery and all of the wickedness and evil that goes on around us. And of course, those stories are true, and those stories need to be aired. And sometimes people write and they say, you know, every time I listen to a broadcast, I become more and more depressed. Is there no hope in life? The Deacon of St. James is one of those classic stories of hope in life. There's a cause and effect relationship that goes on, and that cause and effect relationship affects all of us. I teach a class on business, and I wanted to point out that the Deacon of St. James was illiterate, became a multimillionaire. I've known several men that could not read or write who became millionaires. In fact, I know of more poorly educated people who have become financially successful in life than I do of educated people. And here in America, we have been taught that success in life is dependent upon a college degree and college education. Now, I'm an old man, and I don't have a college education, and I'm not going to tell you what I've got or how much of it. But I'm not dissatisfied with my life, and I'm not dissatisfied with my estate. Now, I want to tell you a couple of short stories here, and I want to tell you what the business principles are that produce success in business. And it has little or nothing to do with being able to read or write, or whether or not you've got a degree from college. In fact, if you have a degree from college, your chances of financial success are materially decreased. Now, that's been my observation. Let me tell you story number one. Frank Rocha, one of my mentors, when I was 15 years old, looking for a summer job, I went out to work on a dairy. Frank Rocha could neither read nor write. And in my employment there, which covered a period of about 3 years while I was going to high school, Frank Rocha had come to the United States in 1922. When he got off the boat in New Bedford, Massachusetts, he had $5 American in his pocket and a job in Lolita, California, 3,000 miles west. He was a young man. He was 22 years old. He was born in 1900. By 1955, Frank Rocha had a dairy, 140 cows, in Lolita, California. By 1970, when he died at age 70, he owned 240 acres, 140 cows, 40 heifers and 40 calves, with the farm equipment that went along with it. Plus, he had a bank account that topped $1 million. Between 1944 and 1970, 44 is when Frank went into business. By 1950, he had the business paid for. In the 20 years from 1950 to 70, he had $1 million saved in the bank, plus the real estate, plus the cattle. Frank Rocha could never read and write. In fact, when he signed his name, you could see marks on the signature line, but it didn't look anything like Frank Rocha. But that didn't mean that he couldn't add and subtract, that he couldn't think, that he couldn't walk, talk, and chew gum and do it all at the same time. Quite a story. A second story that was very impressive to me, and I've known of many men like this, but the second one that I want to relate to you here as we progress along is a guy by the name of Henry. And old Henry, when I first met him, he was in the 9th grade at Eureka High School. Henry was 2 years behind. He was a big, tall, lanky kid. He was bigger than anybody else in the class. Of course, you'd expect that since he was 2 years behind, 2 years older than the other students. He should have been a junior, but he was a freshman in Mrs. Denbo's English class. He was a loner, and he kept pretty much to himself. I think Henry had two or three friends, but you'd never know it by watching him. I never got to know Henry. He was there in the class, and we saw him walking up and down the halls. Not a bad-looking young fella. Just kind of quiet, kind of a loner, dressed well. He wasn't evidently a poor kid. I don't know what it was. We thought that he was kind of a dullard and kind of slow because he was behind in school. And Well, I went to my class reunion. It was my 45th reunion, and I hadn't seen Henry in 45 years. And we were at the reunion, and I happened to see him, and he's a big, tall kid, and he just reminded me of him, and I said, is your name Henry Moore? And he said, yes, it is. And I said, well, let me buy you a drink, Henry, and let's talk a little bit. And so we did. I said, well, we haven't talked or conversed for 45 years. What have you done with your life? What have you accomplished in life? What did you do? He said, well, I went to high school, and when I got out of high school, I went into the trades, and I became an electrician. And he said, now I'm retired, and I have 6 rental houses plus my house. And I said, 6 rental houses? And he got into real estate, and he said, well, not exactly. He said, I built the 6 houses myself. I said, no, that's unusual. You built 6 houses? I said, yeah. Yeah, he said, as I made money, I would buy a lot, and then I would build a house in my spare time. I'd work on the weekends and work at night after work, and I built a house, and then I'd rent it out, and I owned the house free and clear by the time I got through building it, and then I'd rent it out, and I'd save the money from that plus my job, and then I'd build another house, and then I'd build another house. And he said, about every 5, 6, 7 years or so, I'd build a house, and I just owned them. And so now I own 6 houses. I've got them all free and clear, and I've got them all rented. Now, I have a friend there in Eureka who's living in an old house that was built around the turn of the century, maybe before the turn of the century, on Myrtle Avenue. And I asked David, I said, what's this house worth? And he said, well, it's appraised at $236,000. And I couldn't believe it, because you could have bought that house anywhere in the 1950s for $5,000. You know, for a $5,000 house to appreciate to $236,000 is pretty remarkable. Well, Henry built 6 houses since 1960. So, you know, they were all more modern houses than David's. So I just said, well, Henry's houses have to be worth $250,000 each, times 6 is $1,500,000, plus he has a house, doesn't he? Well, the first thing Henry did was to build his own house, and then the second thing Henry did was to build 6 more. So he owns 7 houses. Now, here's a kid with a high school diploma who was, when I met him in school, 2 years behind in class, should have been a junior when we were freshmen, goes out and makes $1.5 million. Now, I assume that he still has his same Social Security, and he probably has his retirement from the union, the Electrical Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and so on. And here's a guy that never went to college. And I don't know of very many professional people that can make that kind of a claim in life. And I could sit here and recite probably 10, 15, maybe more stories of people that I've met in my life that could make that same claim, like the deacon of St. James, who went out, even though late in life, as J.C. Penney, late in life, made the J.C. Penney department stores, and Colonel Chicken, you know, the Colonel Sanders of the KFC fame, didn't get started until he was 60 years old in the business world, and made quite a success of it. And Bill Gates is another one who dropped out of college so that he could create and devote his time to making the enterprise called Microsoft. And Henry Ford, who only went to the 6th grade and created the Henry Ford Motor Company. And Thomas Edison, who only went to the 3rd grade and created 1,200 patents and became a very wealthy and successful man. And the history is just replete with cases like that. Why can't we Americans do that today in 2005? Why is it that Americans are in debt? Why is our government in debt $7 trillion and counting? And why is our balance of payments deficit over $600 billion a year? You hear me make these reports from the economic newsletters, and yes, I will concede those are depressing statistics. But Americans have made a choice. And the choice, in my view, is not the best choice to make. And I make these reports because all of us, as Americans, are going to have to pay the piper at some point in time. George Gordon is going to be one of those who pays the piper, just like you and everybody else in America, for the decisions that our politicians have made from Franklin D. Roosevelt to George Bush. In that 70-year period of time, we Americans made a choice. We elected politicians. Those politicians, with our power of attorney, went to Washington and they went to our state capitals and they gave us paper money and they ran up a tremendous debt, and there's going to be an economic consequence that comes from it. Now, out of this, just like we look at the Roman Empire, when I was a boy, I read a story about the Roman Empire written by Edward Gibbon. It was called Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. It was 3 volumes, and it was over 1,600 pages. That was a lot of reading for a kid in high school. And Gibbon came up with 5 reasons why the Roman Empire collapsed, and one of them was the debasing of their currency. The debasing of their currency, the creation of paper money in today's terms. In those days, they took their gold coins and put more copper in them. They debased their money, just like we have debased our money. And, of course, the Roman Empire is history, isn't it? And America will, at some point in time, go into national captivity. America will become history, based upon the decisions that we made. If we make the same choices that the Romans made, we will, in all probability, come up with the same results that the Romans came up with. And that's just where reality's at. Now, some of us, when we're riding on the Titanic, if you'll remember that story, 1,500 people died, but what they're not telling you is that 800 people survived. And of course, it's the 800 people that survived that we remember. It's not the 1,500 people that died. Twice as many people perished as succeeded or lived. History is replete with those kinds of disaster and success stories. And Noah and the flood is one of those success stories. Everybody in the world died except Noah and his family. 8 souls survived the great flood. We remember the 8 souls that survived. We don't remember the millions or billions that died, do we? Those are the failures in life. So today, in 2005, I want to be one of the successes. I want to be one of those that survives the decline and fall of the American Empire. So as an observer on the scenes, as a reporter, as a historian, as an educator, I look at the history of the world and I say, gee, we Americans are making the same mistakes that the Romans made. But by the same token, I can look at the success of Frank Rocha or the success of Henry Moore, and I can say, gosh, here's a couple of guys that went out and succeeded where others have failed. What is the difference? Why is it that some people succeed and some people fail? Well, over the years, I've developed 82 business principles that I have discovered from people, just like Frank Rocha and Henry Moore and Henry Ford or Thomas Edison. So let me share with you some of these business principles. And keep in mind that when the American economy collapses, like it did in the 1930s, like it did in 1907 and 1841 and in 1783, the collapse of our economy in the United States of America isn't something that occurred once. It has occurred numerous times, and it's going to occur again, because we are making the same decisions and acting in the same fashion today in 2005 that we did prior to the collapse of 1783, 1841, 1873, 1893, 1907, 1922, 1929, 1969. I mean, you know, come on, 1979, 1992, 2000. You know, the business principles, the programs that we Americans engage in produce results, and when we see those results, we ought to learn from them. I'm not sure that we have. Let's take our break here, and we'll come back and see if we can learn some business principles. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. If you'd like a copy to order yours, please call the Law School direct, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. And the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. And keep in mind that the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of the network or of this radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website, georgegordon.org, or call the Law School direct, 417-273-4967. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Tonight's report, the Deacon of St. James. Well, business principles are those actions that we take in the business world to make money. Now, I'm getting old and full of years, and I've made some observations, and I'm going to share them with you. I teach this in my business school. As I said before, I don't have a college degree, and I'm not dissatisfied with my estate in life or my success in life. And my students seem to be happy with their success and their success rate. And so years ago, I was asked by some businessmen if I would teach them what it was that I did at the Atlantis Manufacturing Company to pull that company out of the hole that it was in and to turn it around and to turn it into a success. So I opened Barrister's Inn in Boise, Idaho, and I started teaching law. I started teaching those few students at that time what it was that I did to turn the Atlantis Company around and what it was that made success in business. Now, I have taught literally thousands of people over the last 20 years. That was in 1981. So in the last 24 years, several thousand students have gone through my school. Not all of them are startling successes, but most are. So let's take a look at some incidents here in business, and let me show you some business principles. One of the business principles that I follow is never charge interest and never pay interest. And that's because the Bible prohibits usury and interest. So I looked at that and I said, I wonder if God, the creator of the universe, you know, assuming that there is a God and that you didn't evolve from green slime, could God know something about business? Could God know something about the use of usury and interest that we haven't considered? That maybe usury and interest, whether you pay it or whether you charge it, causes business failure or hinders or holds back your success in business? And the answer to that is yes, it does. Yes, it does, because of the compounding effect of interest, the geometric progression of it. When you buy a house for $50,000 and you make your payments of $300 a month for 360 months, the net loss on the transaction is $90,000 plus. You're buying one house for you and about 1 1/4 houses for the banker at 6% interest. At 8%, it's one for you, two for the banker. At 10%, it's one for you and three for the banker. So the practice of usury and interest, whether you pay it or whether you charge it, is detrimental to your business success. I don't charge interest, and I don't pay interest. And I'm not complaining. Never risk more than you can afford to lose is a business principle that many people, most people, don't understand. In The Deacon of St. James, he took his entire £300 and invested it. Did he risk more than he could afford to lose? I don't think so. Since £300 was all that he had, and he was unemployed, he had to make a decision. We don't have enough to retire, and we have to invest what we have. Is there something that I have an interest in? Tobacco. Do you think I could be a success at it? Well, we don't know. We don't have any demonstrated history. But now we do. He invested his £300. Using other business principles, he made a profit. He invested his profit and developed 14 stores. Over 14 years, he earned £265,000 in 1765. No, he did not risk more than he could afford to lose. He could afford to lose it because he was going to consume it anyway, just on his living expenses. Now, here's another principle. Never trust anybody. Never trust anyone. Now, what kind of a business principle is it that you don't trust anyone? Well, it falls right into place with you never lost any money on any deal you didn't make. And business is not predicated upon trust. Business is predicated upon performance. It's not, do you trust George Gordon? It's, how well does George Gordon perform? I've never asked anybody to trust me. One of my business associates explained that to me one time. He said, you never risk more than you can afford to lose, and you never trust me with your money. I received a package in the mail one time. It had $35,000, 350$100 bills in it. I called the guy that sent it to me, and I said, you fool, you blind, you nitwit. And he said, well, Mr. Gordon, I trust you. And I said, you're a fool because I'm a thief. It's just that my price is higher than $35,000, so I'm not going to steal this $35,000 from you. But most men cannot handle $35,000, and they would steal this money from you. Now, I have a price, but it's higher than $35,000, so don't send me $350,000 or $3,500,000, or you're going to be bitterly disappointed in George Gordon. I hope that that old man learned his lesson. Every man has a price, and every man can be tempted. Never risk more than you can afford to lose, and never trust anyone. If you want to convert $35,000 into gold coin, then you send $5,000 seven times. The thief, if his price is higher than $5,000, will send you the $5,000 order seven times. But if he's a thief and you've tempted him beyond his ability to control himself, then he'll steal your $35,000. Thou shalt not steal is a business principle that we got from Moses. It's one of the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not steal. Theft, or the anti-theft law, is the basis for all personal property rights. You cannot have property rights without a law that says thou shalt not steal. It's the basis of what we in the West, what we call in the Christian world, it's the basis of personal property rights. Now, if you never do business with a thief, you will never be stolen from. So early on, I learned that my government, the United States of America, stole a lot of money from me. They stole it from me in a variety of ways. They did it through the bureaucracy, but they did it with my consent. I went down and signed applications and made contracts and made deals. I violated the law of God when I made contracts with the United States government. I got licenses and permits, and I did business with the government, and indeed I lost a lot of money. I lost money in Social Security until I finally extricated myself from that morass. I lost money on income tax until I finally extricated myself from that morass. I lost money doing business with corporations and corporate capacity, the Secretary of State, OSHA, the EPA, the State Tax Commission, and every government agency that I did business with. And I learned a very valuable lesson, and that is, if you never do business with a thief, you'll never be stolen from. And I always ask a student at the beginning of our class in business, do you or do any of you in the class do business with the mafia? And you know, I have yet to have a student raise his hand and says, oh yes, I'm a loan shark and I work the streets of New York, or yes, I'm a drug dealer and I work for the mafia. So far, I've never had one of those come into my class. And then I asked the second question, I said, why don't you do business with the mafia? Well, people will say, well, because they're criminals. They're thieves and extortioners and drug dealers, and all kinds of wickedness and evil and perversion comes out of the mafia. Then I ask the closing question, is there anything that the mafia does that the United States government does not? Doesn't the United States government or our state governments operate a lottery called the numbers racket? May I ask you, boys and girls, why is it that when the mafia conducts a numbers racket, it's a crime, but when your state government does it, it's a virtue? And how many of you pay the income tax or Social Security voluntarily? You know, when you go to church and they pass the offering plate around, you reach in your pocket and you put a $20 bill into the offering plate. Is that the way you pay your income tax or Social Security? Or isn't that money extorted from you under threat that if you don't pay it, if you don't participate, that we're going to punish you, we're going to do something bad, wicked, terrible, awful, and evil to you? Isn't government then an extortioner? And isn't that what the mafia does, is extortion? There isn't anything that I can think of that the mafia does that government does not do. And when you stop doing business with government, you will begin to practice the first commandment, which says, you shall have no other gods before me. And once you start practicing the first commandment, and you stop doing business with criminal interests and criminal activities like government, you will begin to prosper. Now, credit business is bad business, and Americans do a lot of credit business. They buy cars on credit. They buy houses on credit. And, of course, credit business is bad business because oftentimes people that buy on credit don't pay. So I've discovered that whether you're borrowing the money or lending the money, credit business is bad business. And while credit business is not strictly prohibited in the scripture, it is strictly regulated. You can't charge usury and interest. That takes the incentive for lending out of the equation in business. And since I won't lend to you without interest, you can't borrow from me. And if you don't borrow, the old adage, the borrower is servant to the lender, comes into play. So if you don't want to be my servant, you don't want to borrow from me. And if you don't want to be a servant, then you don't want to borrow. If you want to be a master, then you want to be a lender. If you want to be a master, you want to be a lender. So if you're in debt, you are a debtor. You're not a master. Another old adage that says that gold is the currency of kings and silver is the currency of gentlemen. Barter is the currency of peasants and debt is the currency of slaves. Now take a look at America today and ask yourself, is America a nation of kings, gentlemen, peasants, or slaves? Now you know, the people that deal in gold, silver, or barter are a whole lot further ahead than the people who deal in debt, which is the currency of slaves. And if you're in debt, have you thought about getting out of debt? I always tell a student, you know, you cannot begin to make money until you first get to zero COD. Now, COD means cash on delivery, and zero means that you're at least debt-free. You don't have to have any money to make money. I'm oftentimes told that, oh, it takes money to make money. That's not true. I don't need any money to make money. I can go out and make money at zero COD, but I can't make any money if I'm in debt. I've never been able to do that myself, nor do I know of anybody else that's been able to do that either. Now, I remember one time that I had a financial statement that said that I had $500,000. This was back in Boise, Idaho, and I went into the Bank of Idaho, and my banker looked at my financial statement and he says, "Wow, Gordon, you got $500,000 here." That's what my financial statement said, but that financial statement was a lie. And everybody that fills out one of those financial statements fudges on it, and they lie a lot. That's what I did. The banker knows that. He knows that if you got a financial statement that says that you've got a net worth of $500,000, he knows that it's $250,000 max, and he says of that, $125,000 of it is probably all we're going to get if we have to foreclose. So he looks at your financial statement, he's going to give you about $125,000 out of that $500,000 that you're claiming. That's what your real credit worthiness is. And he knows how to make that discount. He's not dumb. And that's why your banker always wants your financial statement. He wants to see where all of your toys are located and how well you manage your money. That's because your banker is your guardian. That's the guy that you go to borrow money. The banker is a master, but you are a debtor. You're a slave. Now, if you need a license to do your business is a criminal activity. So if you're doing business and you have licenses and you're registered and bonded and insured and etc., then you're in a criminal activity. And that's because the definition of a license is permission to do something that's illegal, unlawful, a tort, or a trespass. And that's why you went to get a license, so that you could violate that law. Because a license is permission to violate one of the laws of God. And every time you violate one of the Ten Commandments, every time you violate one of the statutes, judgments, or commandments, whether it's usury or credit, or it's unjust weights and balances, or thou shalt not steal, whatever the law is that you break has a penalty. Now, there are 28 of these penalties prescribed in the Bible, of which one of them is capital, one of them is death. That's just one out of 28 penalties. The other 27 penalties don't deal with death. They deal with some other punishment. And the loss of your wealth is one of those punishments. Now, I practice what we call the 2% principle. My wife taught me this. We practice the 2% principle. That is, you buy it for a dollar, and you sell it for two, and you make it on that 2%. That's called a keystone markup. What you're looking for in life is a small package that's worth a lot of money, that's very popular, that people want to buy. As old Henry Kaiser worded it, he said, "Find a need and fill it." Now, a business is like a crap table. It is not the place to store your wealth. And yet, I observe that people will create a business, and then they will grow their business, and they will put all of their eggs into that basket. And then when the economy goes bad, or when buggy whips go out of style, or the product that they're selling is no longer a viable product to sell in the marketplace, they lose everything. Instead of taking their profit from time to time and then putting the profit into safety and security, like gold or silver coin or real property or tangibles like wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil, they leave their money in the bank. Well, right now as I speak, in the year 2005, paper money is losing value at the rate of 1% a month, 12% a year. So if you have a business and your business is denominated in dollars and you have dollar investments in your business, losing 12% a year and you have $100,000, at the end of the year, you're going to have $88,000 left. Now, when God told us not to deal in unjust weights and balances, he wasn't whistling Dixie through a straw hat. Paper money is unjust weights and balances. Dealing with banks and credit cards and credit card companies and mortgage companies, etc., is dealing in commercial paper, dealing in commerce. Commerce is strictly prohibited in the scripture, and when you deal in commerce, you don't come out very well. Now, I know a lot of people drive new cars. I don't have a new car to drive. And I'm sure that if you looked at me and you saw the car that I drive, you'd say, "Why, that poor fool." Well, you just keep right on thinking that. I never bought a new car in my life. I'm an old man now. I have never had a new car. And if I live to be 110 years old, I will never own a brand new car. And that's because brand new cars are a bad business investment. And unless I develop Alzheimer's disease or I become deranged in some way, I'm never going to own a new car. Or unless the fundamentals of new car ownership change, then it becomes profitable, you're not going to find me going out and buying a new car. So a business is like a crap table. It's not the place to store your wealth, and I do not store my wealth in my business. And I've never known of any successful people in life that stored all of their wealth in their business. Although that business can be worth a lot of money, and growing your business is a good thing to do. When the profit is there, make sure you take it. Now, whenever we lose money, it's always on a deal that we wish we hadn't made. And so, I learned a lesson from this years ago, and that is, you know, you don't need to make every deal that comes along. And in fact, if you make every deal that comes along, poverty will surely overwhelm you. You're better off to do those deals that make money and avoid those deals that lose money. But how do you know when you go into a deal if it's going to make money or lose money? Well, that's where experience comes in. You know, I've done a lot of deals and I lost a lot of money. And I did a lot of deals and I made a lot of money. And so from my experience, I can now delineate between good deals and bad deals. That's what experience is all about. But you know, there's one other business principle that comes from the Bible of all places. And it's go to the hoary head and learn from the old gray-headed man. There's a second principle that says there's safety in a multitude of counsel. Both of these principles come from the book of Proverbs. Now, the book of Proverbs was written by God to instill wisdom and understanding. Wisdom, understanding, and knowledge are the three greatest assets that you can develop. And so, in chapter 1 of Proverbs, God comes along and says, you want to seek after knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. They're of more value to you than gold, silver, and rubies. Now, most people want gold, silver, and rubies. King Solomon said that he wanted wisdom. God gave him wisdom, and from the wisdom, Solomon became the wealthiest man in the world. So, I would do the same thing, and that's one of the business principles that I have learned over the years. I'm not so concerned about how much gold or silver. I'm more concerned about how do you make an intelligent business deal? Because if I can develop wisdom and avoid the bad business deals and just concentrate on the good business deals, the gold and the silver and the rubies will flow automatically. So the book of Proverbs is the number one book to teach business management. Business management comes from the book of Proverbs. Now, opportunity is like rain. Opportunity is everywhere. And it's like running water. And it needs to be channeled for best results. When you hear somebody make this proverb, they say, opportunity only knocks once. That's a false statement. That's a false proverb. That is a proverb of fools. opportunity is everywhere. And if you have wisdom, understanding, and knowledge, you can see these little gems of business opportunity everywhere. Now, we're about to enter into a period of great peril. The Apostle Paul pointed that out. He said, "Brethren, in the future there are perilous times." He used the word perilous times coming. And yet, in the Great Depression of the 1930s, I met more men in my business career who made money in the Great Depression than lost money. That's right. More money was made in the Great Depression by more people than was lost. And that's because every time you have a depression, what you're really dealing with here is an inventory liquidation. The people who are in debt lose everything that they've got. Well, not maybe not everything, but they lose a great portion of what they've got. And that wealth is transferred to somebody else. Right now, we're at the top of a real estate bubble. The top of this real estate bubble is a great opportunity. It's a great opportunity because here in this county, 20 years ago, land was selling for $250 to $1,000 an acre. Today it sells for $1,000 to $10,000 an acre. When the bubble breaks, the real estate is going to go back to $250 to $1,000 an acre. All right, so it doesn't take a great genius to figure out. What we want now is to be flush with cash. So now's the time to sell your real estate and convert to cash. Convert the cash to gold so that the 12% inflation doesn't erode it. Then wait for the collapse and then come back into the marketplace, convert your gold to paper, take the paper, and buy the real estate so that 40 acres today at $10,000 an acre can be converted into 4,000 acres after the collapse. I mean, you know, it's just a matter of using your head and thinking and taking advantage of the opportunities that are out there. So instead of becoming despondent, let's learn a lesson from the deacon of St. James, that while adversity and the loss of your job may be a traumatic experience, it can also be the beginning of a great business career. Remember, J.C. Penney and Colonel Chicken did not get started until they were 60 years old. 60. So if you're 40 or 50 or 60 years old or 70 or 80 and you're sitting there crying in your beer saying, "Oh my God, I've missed the brass ring." Let me tell you that from zero COD, it takes just 36 months to make $100,000 in gold buried in a hole in the ground. And if you'd like to learn more about how to do that, why don't you call the law school and ask for our free general law CD package and let me start you on your new business career. And you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, of which one of those schools is our business school. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Well, there's the signal. Says our time's up. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.